Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by the second annual Catskill Cuisine Festival. Visit catskill-cuisine.com to learn more and buy tickets.
This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. On the next episode, we are celebrating the diverse Middle Eastern flavors that are part of the Midwestern culinary landscape. Meet Zorhit Heilinger, a Yemenite raised in Israel who is now a Minnesota-based culinary instructor behind the website Mideast to Midwest. And get a taste of Galit, a Middle Eastern fine dining restaurant in Chicago. I'll talk to their co-owner and chef, Zach Engel.
Zorhit, we're excited to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So where are you based now?
Minneapolis for the past 36 years.
Oh, fantastic. So you've been based in the Twin Cities for a long time, but you grew up in Israel. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was born and raised in Israel and ended up moving to Minneapolis in the late 80s.
So you ended up coming to Minneapolis, St. Paul 36 years ago. You grew up in Israel, but if I recall correctly, you are Yemeni as well, correct?
That's correct. My parents came to Israel in 1949 from Sana'a, and I was raised in a very multicultural neighborhood. We had our cluster of family members who were from Yemen, and we had all around us people from Morocco and Romania and Iran and Iraq and from Russia, Holocaust survivors, North Africans. So it was a very diverse community to grow up in, and you know, everything that was celebrated through food and music and traditions was shared throughout the neighborhood. So I feel very mm-hmm. fortunate to have been exposed to so much richness of culture.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no replacement for something like that. I mean, it's such a unique environment to be able to live in and, you know, be able to share such a variety of different types of cultural traditions, like you said, food, music. And I can imagine that really had informed, you know, your experience, not only growing up, but maybe even coming to the Twin Cities, to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and recognizing the value that food has when it comes to bringing cultures and communities together.
Yes, I'm really fascinated by how, you know, history, everything from, let's say, the spice trade and, mm-hmm. You know, world trends really shaped the food that we eat and we take for granted, and how food actually fosters communication and closeness and intimacy. And, you know, I think when you invite someone into your home and you share with them food that is close to your heart or is mm-hmm. rooted in your culture and share that part of yourself, that opens up a lot of doors for conversation that otherwise would not be open.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I've spoken to a lot of different organizations and individuals and in many walks of life over the years, doing this show now for almost 4 years, believe it or not. And, you know, when I've spoken to folks, particularly, you know, I am just recalling some conversations I had with women who'd come over from Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, you know, and also parts of East Africa, like Eritrea and Ethiopia, and in communities mm-hmm. in the Midwest, you know, resettling and using food as this way to communicate and share about their culture in their new home. And so I've always found it very powerful. And in your own experience, what kind of foods you mentioned, you know, when you share food that's close to your heart, maybe give us some examples of some kind, you know, any kind of food that, you know, you really feel is important to you and really is expressive of, you know, your community and your culture.
Well, that's a really interesting question because, in a way, you know, as a Yemeni Jew, Yemenite Jews developed a lot of customs and foods around Shabbat since they were living in a Muslim community. And we have a slew of types of breads that actually bake overnight for Shabbat that mm-hmm. have become so popular in Israel that you can find them in the freezer sections in Israel. So I'm going to give the example of jachnun, which mm-hmm. My kids, jachnun and kubane, those are two types of breads that basically you make on a Friday, you place in the oven overnight, and you eat it on Saturday morning. And that's sort of to comply with the Jewish tradition of not working on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, so you don't have to make food. And that bread is this, the jachnun, is this delicate, almost rolled up, if you can imagine, like a cigar, but literally like a tobacco cigar, but made out of thin dough that's rolled up and baked overnight until it's really browned and caramely, and with some eggs that are roasted on that low temperature overnight as well.
Wow.
And you eat it in the morning with grated tomato and shog, which is a Yemenite hot sauce. And along with the eggs, and it's just this, and you drizzle over it samneh, which is a Yemenite clarified butter that is a butter roasted with toasted fenugreek seeds. So
oh, wow.
That is very, very specifically Yemenite. And I have four children who are all grown and are away from home. And when we all get together at our home, the one thing that they ask for is a Yemenite Shabbat breakfast. And it's kind of a tradition. We sit together. And when I have company over the weekend, you know, people who actually stay with me overnight, very often I will make that as a sort of as a gateway to explain how Yemenite food was actually influenced by Indian food, because Yemen is the last port of the spice trade before, you know, caravans would go through Saudi Arabia on camelbacks mm-hmm. before the Suez Canal was open. So Yemenite cuisine has a lot of different spices that normally people identify with Indian food, like mm-hmm. fenugreek and cardamom. Ginger, those kind of spices. So it's kind of opens up a really interesting conversations about trade and migration and culture and influence. And I really love to introduce people to that slice of Yemeni food. And then I love to talk about North African food, and because I think sometimes people think of Jewish food, especially in the States, in America, people think mm-hmm. of Jewish food as gefilte fish, matzo ball soup, bagels and cream mm-hmm. cheese and lox. And not to say that is not identified with the Jewish culture as well, but that's traditionally Jews who migrated to Europe. This is not Jews who were expelled or migrated to North Africa, Yemen, India, mm-hmm. Afghanistan, Bukhara, all of those places. That is a very, very different kind of food culture.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, you've put this so eloquently, you know, how food is not only a gateway to open conversations, but is a very unique tool to be able to capture, you know, aspects of migration, immigration, trade, and tells a very, you know, specific story that, you know, I feel only food can do. I mean, you know, what you just described as far as, you know, why there is a substantial Indian influence on Yemeni food. You know, you wouldn't have necessarily, I certainly wouldn't have known, but it makes total sense. And all of a sudden, you know, you're realizing that that these flavors end up in certain places for a very specific reason. So you get a history lesson, a geography lesson, an agricultural lesson, you know, alongside that greater cultural conversation.
Yeah, you know, when I was when I moved here, I was exposed to Mexican food, and you know, I love El Pastor tacos, and then I researched it a little bit, and then found out that it has actually a Greek influence. It's actually Greek immigrants to Mexico who developed that. So it's like, you know, it's very interesting to see how you know what a taco that we think of as very traditionally Mexican is actually a different culture's influence on Mexican food, you know? So yeah. I think, you know, when we look at the world and how we think about food, I think it's very important to tell the story. You know, like when I teach cooking classes and when I teach a certain recipe, I love to tell the, you know, sort of identify the DNA of a recipe and say, well, this is actually originally a Palestinian recipe, and Israeli Iraqis took it and added this, and Israeli Yemenis added that, and now it's become part of Israeli cuisine. And while the roots are, let's say, Palestinians or Iraqi or Russian, now it's you know, sort of morphed into something different. And I love to tell how when you enter an Israeli restaurant, sort of kind of a workers' restaurant, the one thing that you get without, as you sit down, the owners will just put in front of you a spread of small plates, like a meze kind of thing. And the small plates, if you start identifying what's on the small plates, it's like the Jewish diaspora on the table.
You will have interesting.
A Russian egg salad. You will have a Romanian corn salad. You will have a Moroccan carrot salad. You will have Yemenite tzhog, which is the spicy sauce. You will have, you know, Iraqi pepper salad. All of these things are representations of the different ethnic groups who ended up in Israel, and that plate is, to me, it's just like a map of Jewish communities from around the world, and I find that fascinating. You know,
absolutely, and you know, I mean, again, so poignant, and I think it shows when you have all those things on the same plate how we can learn about one another, and I think sometimes recognize that we have more in common than maybe we realize. So I want to kind of just switch gears back to, you know, you ended up coming to the United States, moving to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area about 36 years ago. And obviously you came from this incredibly rich culinary, backstory, for lack of a better term. And you're still making all of these incredible dishes, but was there a bit of a challenge trying to find some of the ingredients that you would need to make these authentic dishes in one way, shape, or form that you were trying to, you know, bring these flavors to the table in the United States?
You know, I've seen a huge change in availability of ingredients in the country since, you know, for the last 15, 20 years. But first, you know, a little bit of confession. You know, when I moved here, I must admit that I took my culture and the food of my culture for granted. You know, it was available to me. I didn't think twice of it. I didn't even like cooking, you know. and then I moved here, and all of a sudden, the things that were available to me as a matter of course were completely absent. Not only absent, people didn't even know what I was talking about. The only spice that I could really trust on finding was cardamom, because it was part of the Swedish-Norwegian baking tradition, you know?
And that's a big part of the, you know, the Scandinavian influence is a big part of the culture of the upper Midwest.
Right, right. So people were very familiar with that. But interestingly, only in ground form, you know, people were not familiar.
Right.
If I showed someone the pod of a cardamom, they didn't know what it was, you know. So it was very interesting. But I've seen a tremendous change. And I think everything from curiosity about other cultures and about other mm-hmm. other foods and traditions, availability of ingredients, a very strong interest in eating and grow and cooking local and seasonal, which I think is a tremendous, tremendous move that is happening in the country. And I love to see that. And I think in some regards, moving to Minnesota, which is such a agricultural state, at first I was a little bit stumped, like, how can this be such an agricultural state and have so many things unavailable? But over time, I learned how to source things here and find my little ethnic grocers that carried some of the things that I needed. And then slowly that movement, you know, moved into the bigger supermarkets and to the farmers markets. And in Minnesota, we have a wonderful, wonderful Hmong community who are a big part of our farmers markets. And they provide such beautiful products during the summer that, you know, I go to the farmers market, I have my favorite few vendors that I have a relationship with, and everything from beautiful fresh herbs to beautiful fresh products. And a lot of them are now growing without pesticides and as wow. organic as possible. A lot of them cannot afford certification, but you know,
right. they it's a different story
to the spirit of it. Yes, yes, that's a different story. Yeah. So yes, I do see a huge change and I applaud it, you know, and speaking of local, just yesterday, you know, I love discovering, local artisans that are, really raising the bar as far as quality of products. And just yesterday I, discovered a locally produced, vanilla extract and vanilla paste right here in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities.
Incredible.
This company called the Vanilla Bean Project. And Sarah and Andy Kubiak just decided to be really forward-thinking, and they are supporting women in Madagascar, in Papua New Guinea, and are doing regenerative organic farming there. And producing this beautiful, beautiful vanilla extract and paste. And I can't wait to start using it, you know, local and supporting women. And it's just a beautiful project. So I love discovering that and highlighting that in my website as well. And encouraging people to support, you know, artisans that are trying to do good in the work in the world through the food industry.
Absolutely. So let's talk actually a little bit about your website and your cooking classes and the work that you've done. How did you decide that you were going to, you know, create this website and share recipes and you know, stories around, you know, your culinary activities and your travels as well?
Well, you know, my husband, Matt, is a very solid partner. I'm a bit like that, you know, like that dog in the Disney the Disney movie, like squirrel, you know. I'm like following the squirrels wherever they show up. I'm very spontaneous, and Matt, my husband, is very good at helping me process things and things through very methodically. And one of the things that I discovered as I was trying different things in the food industry, I was dabbling in teaching, dabbling in catering, dabbling in, I had a food line for a year where I produced to order Middle Eastern items, everything from hummus to eggplant to soups and all of that. And one of the things he encouraged me to do is to experiment with different aspects of the food industry and find what works well for me, what really resonates for me. I'm an English lit major from the University of Tel Aviv, and writing has always been part of my life. And mm-hmm. I found that standing in the kitchen and producing for catering or for a food line, while I love the food, I love the interaction with people much more so. And it really energizes me to interact with people. So I tried focusing on the cooking classes, and that was a fabulous fit for me. And then I wanted to share the recipes and the stories to a wider audience, which is part of the reason I started the website. And I find the two complement one another because they both, in my cooking classes and in the website, I try to combine food with storytelling.
Yes.
Because I think every recipe has a story behind it, and we relate differently to food. Food nourishes not just our bodies, our souls as well. If it's prepared with love, if we know, this is a recipe from great grandma and she carried it in her pocket on the boat from, from, let's say, Ireland. Okay. There's a meaning there, there's a comfort and a connection in the food that wouldn't exist. And a friend of mine who is a physician said to me at one point, which I thought was so poignant, he said, we talk about food and we talk about calories, but we forget that calories are energy. They're energy. So the energy you put into making something, the energy that you invest in feeling about the food and in about presenting the food is the energy the person receiving it is going to get. And that stayed with me for years. And the thought of what am I offering? I'm not just offering food. I'm offering a piece of myself. And
that's powerful.
When I do that and try to do that with love and openness and some vulnerability, most of the time people react in the same way. And that creates a relationship and a bond that is very, very precious.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, give us some examples of some of the cooking classes that you've done, and the type of things that you cover and who you welcome into these cooking classes.
So I'm very, very fortunate that several organizations here in town, like the Nordic Ware brand, the Nordic Ware Teaching Kitchen, has welcomed me. There's a chain of kitchen stores here in the Twin Cities called Cooks of Crocus Hill that have beautiful teaching kitchens in their stores that I've been fortunate to teach. And then, of course, in the Jewish community. So I've been very fortunate to teach in the wider, to a wider audience, non-Jews and Jews as well. And I love that, I can walk into a cooking class not knowing who is going to be in the class, and I can have someone from Syria come up to me after class and talk about the similarities and some of the things that I have offered and their childhood memories. And I think as someone from Israel, I probably would never have a chance to talk to somebody from Syria in that way. There's something about breaking those boundaries that the food allows us to do, which I love. So I try and offer, on one hand, I call it Mediterranean/Middle Eastern contemporary cuisine. So while my food is rooted in classical Middle Eastern, and I do teach like classical Middle Eastern appetizers and entrees, etc., I love to take some of those spices, some of those flavors, and create something new. So, for example, just last week I taught a class called It Is Easy Being Green. You know that famous Kermit song,
Yes, of course.
I have a soft spot for Kermit, Who's,
I mean, who doesn't?
Green frog in the midst of chaos, right? Yes. And I created basically a green menu that focused on a green dip that was made with peas and mint and artichoke hearts based on Adina Sussman's cookbook, Shabbat. And then I created my own dish where I took the traditional Israeli schnitzel and made a green tapenade sauce for it and served it on top of jasmine rice that was folded into sautéed power baby greens that made the green rice, the rice green. And then we had, for dessert, we had a pistachio rosewater cardamom cake. So the green was throughout, and the flavors were Middle Eastern and Mediterranean, but the putting them together was contemporary.
Mm-hmm. That sounds incredible. I mean, and you really get creative with those ingredients. And you know, how do folks react when you bring these kind of you know, different flavors together?
I think one of the things, I guess the thread that goes through some of the classes is surprise. You know, people tend to be a little reluctant to try new things. And I tease them in class. I tried to create this sort of fun camaraderie, a sense of community in the class, you know, no stupid questions, you know, everybody's welcome to talk and interact with me while I'm cooking and chatting. And people sometimes are so surprised that such simple ingredients that you see on the shelf and you don't think twice about can create so much flavor and so much texture. And I love to surprise people that way. And I think people think that you need to work really hard to create vibrant flavors. And I love to teach a few techniques and how to combine things that have been simmering for a while with something fresh or a little bit citrus or, you know, a fresh herb at the end, and how everything just kind of pops and comes to life. And just giving people, I guess, some tips and some tricks to have up their sleeves so they don't feel like cooking is a chore, and to bring back the joy and the enjoyment. I say, you don't have to cook for yourself every day, but maybe make a promise to yourself you'll cook for yourself once a week. Start with that.
Yeah.
And put the music on. If you're into wine, pour yourself a glass of wine. Relax into it. And just enjoy the process as much as sitting down to eat it. And before you sit down to eat it, make sure that you have a nice place setting, that you have an aesthetic environment to enjoy the food that you worked to produce for yourself. And just as a way of, incorporating food and preparing it into your self-care routine. I think that's really important.
Yeah, there's a lot of healing that can be done, you know, and a lot of mindfulness that can be done in the kitchen as well, slowing down and really, you know, connecting and grounding yourself. I love that. I think it's so valuable for folks. And, you know, it's a great way to reconnect with yourself and connect with others around you as well, taking that time.
Absolutely. And I think as a society, we are all feeling the absence of that. You know, we're all suffering from the absence of that.
Sure. No question about that. So tell me a little bit about what, you know, your future plans are. I mean, you've done so many different types of things. I know, you know, you from the cooking classes to sharing recipes to, as you said previously, you know, doing things like catering. And I know you've also done, you know, some contributing writing as well for publications like Edible Minnesota. You know, what do you see as your mission going forward with the work that you're doing related to food and culture?
You know, I have some big dreams, and they are all anchored in a cookbook that I'm very slowly working on, and hoping that 2024 will be the magical year of putting the cookbook together, and hopefully in 25, putting it out there. The goal for me is to, you know, this may sound really bombastic, but to try and foster, you know, closeness between people, a sense of community for people, to build communities, even if it's a community of communities, you know. I think I see the people who come into my class, and in the beginning of the class, they're strangers. Mm-hmm. By the end of the class, they're exchanging phone numbers, you know, and especially participation classes where I try to really have people interact amongst themselves. And, you know, they will come to me and say, well, we don't know how to do that. And I say, well, you're in charge. Okay, what do you think? You know, what do you think? You know, pointing fingers at them and say, okay, talk to one another. You know, do you think he did this well? How would you that do that differently? How can you assist this person? Basically to just, you know, I think to some degree, as a culture, we have pursued individualism to such a degree that we lost the sense of community, and we need to find a balance between the two. You know, as someone who has four kids that I encourage their independence, and they're all far away from home and living a full life, I'm all for that. But I think we need to find ways to create communities for ourselves that support us. And food is a vehicle for that. You know, it creates community. And I'd like to do my part in helping people eat healthier, create community for themselves, find ways to connect with their roots and their culture, and provide, you know, create a richness of life. And I know it sounds really big and bombastic, but I guess baby steps is the way to look at it.
I don't think that it's too big of a dream. I think that it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, food is powerful, as we've been discussing through our entire conversation. You know, food can be that, you know, storyteller, and can be that anchor to bring people together. Thank you for taking the time, and we look forward to hearing what you do next.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out with me, Capri Cafaro. After the break, I'll be welcoming our next guest, Chef Zachary Engel, the co-owner and operator at Galit, a Middle Eastern restaurant in Chicago.
Gather your friends and family at the second annual Catskill Cuisine Festival, presented by the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, and Resorts World Catskills. Mark your calendars for a flavor-packed weekend from May 10th to May 12th. Experience the fusion of phenomenal food and electrifying entertainment. Rub shoulders with your favorite Food Network personalities, including Andrew Zimmern, Michael Simon, Scott Conant, Marcus Samuelson, Jeffrey Zakarian, Anne Burrell, Melba Wilson, and distinguished international chefs by LaBelle Farms. Kick off the festivities with Friday's star-studded golf tournament and evening reception. Saturday heats up with free tastings, thrilling live demos, music, and family activities, culminating with a gourmet dinner hosted by celebrity chefs. And on Sunday, celebrate Mother's Day with a special celebrity-curated brunch. Tickets for this celebration are selling like hotcakes. Visit Catskill-Cuisine.com to grab your pass for this unforgettable weekend in the picturesque Catskills. See you there.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. This show is all about how the diverse flavors of Middle Eastern cuisine are part of the Midwestern culinary landscape. Earlier in the program, I spoke with culinary instructor and founder of the website, MideastToMidwest.com, Zarit Heilinger. Now, I want to bring in our next guest, Zachary Engel. Zachary is a James Beard Award-winning chef and one of the co-owners and operators of Galit, a gourmet Middle Eastern restaurant in Chicago that makes a point to use seasonal ingredients grown and produced in the Midwest. Chef Zach, thank you for joining Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thanks for having me.
I am just so impressed with Galit, and I have to say I am disappointed that I have not been there yet. I don't often get out to Chicago, even though I am an Ohio native and reside here in northeastern Ohio, so I guess I need to get on I-80 and start traveling west.
Yeah, I mean, I made that drive a couple of times, and it's not fun. I don't blame you for not getting to Chicago more often.
Well, it's going to happen.
It seems like it'd be closer than it is, right?
Yeah, you know, people I think do, but it's really, it's a minute, but you know what? It sounds like it's very worth it to get, you know, the kind of a fresh and creative food, these Middle Eastern flavors that you are offering at Galit. So, let's start out. Tell us a bit about, because you have a pretty, you know, extensive background as a chef, you know, receiving a number of James Beard Awards. I know that you've, you know, been, you know, you've worked in kitchens in every place from Philadelphia to Tel Aviv, and even and up in the Napa region in Sonoma County. What brought you, you know, to Chicago, to this concept and joining forces with your partner in this business, Andreas?
Yeah. So, I mean, after cooking in a bunch of places, working for a bunch of chefs, learning a lot, I landed back in New Orleans where I went to college at Tulane and hooked up with my first chef, Alon Shaya. And he hired me as opening chef at Shaya, which was kind of where my career really jettisoned off. Mm-hmm. And then it got to a point where he had a couple of restaurants. I was a culinary director, and I wanted more for myself, for my family. Mm-hmm. And New Orleans is sort of it's a great town, but it's a small town. There was not enough room for me and Alon to operate. And so the obvious thing was for me to look around. And Chicago's sort of like a decision I made based off of like what was best for my family. We had our youngest daughter, Margalit, was like 6 months old at the time. And my wife, her mom's from South Bend, so sure, she has some Midwest roots. We had a lot of friends here. I really liked visiting here. I really dug sort of the hospitality and warmth of the Midwest.
Yeah.
And then my business partner, Andreas, he was working as a senior accountant for One-Off Hospitality of Blackbird, Publican, Avec fame. And then he was moonlighting as a maitre d', like sort of host manager at Nico Osteria, one of the restaurants. And we reconnected when he came to visit New Orleans once to go to a Saints game. And when I decided I was going to come to Chicago, I knew I needed a business partner. And his front of the house style and his expertise in the business side of it also was a really good match. I think on paper, we're a really great fit. We're also like the two most stubborn people in the world. So it's, you know, like we've never worked together before. So it was a very smart partnership. He was a former accountant at Deloitte for many years and also went to Tulane at the same time as me.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was like, hey, I'm going to move to Chicago. I think I'm going to open a restaurant. Do you want to do it? He was like, let me call you back. And he was like, sorry, I was actually at work and Donnie Medea was talking to me. So I was like, maybe not going to answer you at the moment. But yes, I'd love to do that. And so we just kind of dove right in and settled on this space in Lincoln Park. And this is now like our neighborhood, our home.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And both of you, you know, brought your experiences and your culinary tastes, I think, to this Galit concept, which is, you know, very, you know, Middle Eastern driven in its dishes and in its ingredients. I understand that Andreas is, you know, has a Palestinian heritage, and you are Jewish and has spent a lot of time in Israel. And how have those culinary experiences informed how you have developed the menu?
So Andres grew up on holidays, rolling grape leaves and making kibbeh with his whole family. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the thing that everyone does. There's actually a picture in the restaurant of multiple generations of women in his family, from his mother's side, who are all the Palestinian side, rolling grape leaves and making kibbeh. So it's like definitely a part of our story. He grew up with the food, but the dude can't really cook. So I take the reins.
That's where you
on
come
in. Yeah. Yeah. I also like, I can't run a reservation system. So works out just fine for both of us.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I really connected at a young age on my first trip to Israel with like the food and the experience. And then I went back a couple more times as a young adult. And then I ended up cooking there for a period of time. And I've been studying it and learning about it and eating at restaurants and talking to chefs. And it's just kind of everything is consumed in my life by Middle Eastern food. Really love it. I spent time in Israel living with a Yemenite Israeli family in a suburb outside of Tel Aviv. And I learned all of their family recipes, some of which landed on the opening menu at Galit.
Wow.
And it's for us, it's we're telling this narrative of food from the area, but we're also telling it in a way that's familiar and convivial to the Midwest. Like our use of seasonal Midwest produce, meat and poultry and fish, as well as like grains and other products, like all from the Midwest as much as we can. And that makes people feel more accustomed to what we're doing and see the connection, or how you can make that connection. And then it has so much to do with like sort of this hospitality that exists. When you walk into someone's home, in my experience, like being invited over for dinner or Shabbat dinner in someone's home, and there's just like tons of food on the table and people are passing bottles of wine and the conversation is light and there's music playing and it's lively. Like that is the environment that we try and imitate here at Galit with the dinner experience. Sort of like sit back and relax, make a few choices, but pretty much we're just going to give you a lot of food and it's going to be good.
That's right. So you have this really interesting, you know, kind of concept and approach that I can see could really be evocative of, you know, a hospitable, warm home with, it's a 4-course meal, as it says here, choose your own adventure.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have a number of different courses that you can select. And one, you talked about using Midwestern ingredients, something that stood out here is walleye, you know, which is very much the pride of the Great Lakes. How much time do you spend trying to develop the dishes and the flavors that you put on your menu seasonally?
It's an interesting question. Some things happen immediately. Like I'll conceptualize something. Usually towards the end of a season, I'll sit down and like evaluate the things that we typically change on the menu. We have some fixtures that we don't really touch just because I think that that's really important for a restaurant to have. Is to have like the go-tos that people come back for.
Sure.
And we'll change the things that need changing, you know, like sunchokes and apples are kind of done. So that dish will change at some point. But I'll have an idea and sometimes it works immediately. Right now I'm doing a spring menu change and I've had a couple of just straight bombs. I've had ones that I've like conceptualized and then started to do and then been like, this isn't actually what I want to be doing with these ingredients. I try and spread it out based off of what I know the farmers are going to start popping off with pretty soon. So there's an asparagus dish. There's something with Akurai turnips. There's rhubarb. There's all sorts of different peas. Potentially artichoke. So I kind of have I've planned for the last 5 years. Like I've seen where the seasons end up and what starts coming up when, around what time. And so I can plan mm-hmm. accordingly for, you know, a 2 month period, give or take.
Right.
And so, you know, like I said, sometimes it just clicks. Sometimes I got to go back to the drawing board a few more times before I'm satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the idea works, but it just needs to get tweaked a little bit. And then I think that now with this 4-course menu, and like in 2022, we received our first Michelin star. And so we're not doing anything differently, but I do feel like I have to make sure that I am pushing myself creatively and providing an opportunity for the cooks to feel challenged mm-hmm. with new techniques and flavors so that they are really capitalizing on the time that they spend here in the kitchen. And they're really like getting a grasp for how I'm cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of this is things that have been built up over the last 10 years of creating dishes that are through the Middle Eastern lens. All of my 5 years in New Orleans at Chaya and like all the things I created there, there are components that find their way constantly, into dishes, that I always go back to because I'm like, that's super killer. And we can apply it to this different ingredient mm-hmm. as opposed to something that maybe it was a summer thing and now we're going to apply it to a winter ingredient.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It occurs to me as I hear you, you know, describing all of this and talking about pushing yourself creatively and engaging the cooks to, you know, make sure they're getting the most out of their experience. You know, as a consumer, as a diner, you know what, I look at this menu and maybe others that aren't as familiar with Middle Eastern flavors, Middle Eastern dishes. To me, this, I mean, you know, it's incredibly creative. You know, you could leave it as is. And it would, you know, if someone is new to it, it is something that is, you know, really groundbreaking because these may be flavors you've never experienced before. I mean, I may be showing some of my ignorance, but I'm looking at the Nez menu and at the Iraqi Kuba Halab. I have no idea what that is. Can you tell me?
Yeah, that's a cool one. So that's a dish that is a little bit off the beaten path for a lot of people. Kibbeh is very, I think, more well-known, where it's the bulgur and lamb shell
for a
dumpling with the ground lamb cooked inside, usually with pine nuts, spices. Mm-hmm. And that's ubiquitous in the Levant region. The Kuba Halab is one that I've seen mostly from Iraqi, Persian, Iranian cooking. It's a saffron rice crust. So think like a Persian tadig, but instead of it being in a pan, it is a dumpling form. And then inside we have lamb coming from Catalpa Grove Farm that we cook sort of like a Iraqi, like bolognese kind of.
Oh, interesting.
And then it gets served with a sort of like a romesco almost with like almond butter and golden raisins and ras al-hanout.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
And so that to me is, besides the sauce, that to me is a very straightforward dish. We're not trying to do anything besides show you a very well thought out executed version of what someone who knows what Iraqi Kuba Halab is, that they would be like, that's Kuba Halab. It's indistinguishable from what I believe it to be. Versus some of our other stuff is gets a little esoteric sometimes.
So give me an example of an esoteric dish.
I was talking about the sunchoke dish. I've also dabbled a little bit, you know, in some just different cooking techniques just to kind of keep it fresh for myself personally. And because I like to apply things that I read about or whatever into what we're doing. So the sunchokes, those are cured in miso. So miso zuke. So we're like burying it in miso for a day and then brushing all the miso off, roasting in fenugreek, apple cider syrup, from seedling farms in Michigan. And then it's got shaved apples, honey crisps. There is a carob molasses tahini on the bottom. So it's sort of like carob, for people who aren't that familiar, is sort of like why I like to tell the cooks, it's like the OG chocolate. Like before cacao beans were a thing, carob was like what you used for sweet things in the Middle East. It still is very like ubiquitous ingredient. And I really like it for the chocolate kind of like tobacco notes that it has. And then there's a, when they were in season, we were using matsutake mushrooms, just shaving them super thin raw. Right now we're using danko grade shiitake mushrooms that we sprinkle with a little matsutake powder on top. And this dish is like not really Middle Eastern, you know, like it isn't in a lot of ways, but the idea of a root vegetable in tahini, no matter what it is, like that to me is like the classic, you know,
right. I can see that.
Tahini, turnips, tahini, carrots and tahini, all of it is just, it's just like the perfect snack. And this kind of pulls in a lot of different directions, and the flavor profile is a little bit bizarre too. You know, apples and sunchokes work together. Sunchokes and mushrooms works together. Mushrooms and chocolate works together. But does like chocolate really work with apples and sunchokes, you know? But the way the dish kind of pulls together is kind of fun, because you get everything in like little blips on your palate throughout each bite. And that one's just like a little bit, I swung for the fences on that one and I was like, this may not work at all. And then it turns out it was great.
Sometimes taking a risk really pays off, and you painted such an incredible picture. Sometimes it's so hard to do when you're doing, you know, straight audio and you're talking about food, which is such a visual experience. It's a sensory experience. You smell the taste, you know, the feel, all of those things, none of which we can do on radio and in podcast form, but you've really captured an essence of something that sounds so incredibly unique. What's next for your work at Galit?
So Galit, the food is sort of going to continue in this 4-course menu, where we're cooking seasonally. The way I define it is it's a Midwestern restaurant through a Middle Eastern lens. It's kind of more of how I look at it, because I'm so much more focused on the ingredients we're getting. Than necessarily like trying to be true to form Middle Eastern.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't say Galit authentic Middle Eastern restaurant on the door.
Right.
Like it just says Galit. And what we've been really focusing on lately a lot is our wine program also. We have, I would say, the most extensive list of Middle Eastern wines of a top quality in the United States. I really think that our wine program is very unique, and our the way we operate it, we have a similar kind of journey menu through the Middle East where we match different wines to each of the courses. And some of them you can't get anywhere else. Like no one else has bought it, and we bought all of it. There's nothing else in the United States. It changes based off of our availability. So sometimes we're getting different things and then it goes away and then we won't have it for 3 months and we have to put something else on. But it's a really cool way for us to support the wineries in the Middle East that we work with a lot and help them to move more product through the United States, which is a big thing. Like the more you move, the more exposure you're getting, the bigger your business grows.
Absolutely. And I mean, I had no idea. I mean, I had some vague idea that about Middle Eastern wines, but you know, not anything of any substance. And so I definitely something else I would want to try and take that journey. Like you said, that pairing.
Yeah. It's a pretty special experience. We're very happy about it. And then as far as the rest of, we're working on another restaurant currently. And so hopefully that'll be open by the end of the year. And Galit is sort of in this great phase where the staff's really killing it. And I can, from above, create and dictate to people like what we're doing with the food. But I don't necessarily need to be pushing it past where it is right now. Like, we're going to continue to do a consistent product, and our main focus is going to be like building the business out and mm-hmm. diversifying our portfolio and our customer base a little bit.
And your business model, and I can't let you go without touching upon this. I mean, your business model, your corporate culture, for lack of a better term, is one that seems to be very focused on its people and investing in the team and making sure that folks are appropriately compensated and respected in that way. Just tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, what you do on that end.
Yeah, so I think the most recent change for us we went to a service charge model. There's a lot of changes going on in the political movements in Chicago that are kind of, mm-hmm. we're trying to navigate that and figure it out before everything changes very quickly on us. So we moved to a service charge model. And what that does is that allows us to also use some of the service charge income to compensate the cooks a little bit more. And so they get a percentage of food sales shared evenly among them, which is really nice because we do pay them really well and they get a lot of benefits, but the pay disparity in fine dining doesn't exist in the front of the house. It exists in the back of the house. Like that's right. where people fall far behind. And so that's really great to give them a little bit of something extra. We have been doing healthcare coverage for our employees since a month into us opening in 2019. We have a very good plan for a small business, like the best that you can really get for a business with under 50 employees.
Sure.
Since the pandemic, we have provided it in full to all of our non-tipped employees. So back of the house employees and managers. We recently started a 401k for anyone that's been with us for over a year.
Incredible.
Which we have several people who have been with us for over 5 years now since we opened. And a lot of it starts with the very beginning. When we do those interviews, we explain to every person, this is how this is going to go. This is what we're promising you, how we're going to operate. These are the benefits. This is the schedule. These are the days that we're closed, et cetera, et cetera. We don't tolerate any form of harassment or discrimination. We don't we're a dry house. We don't drink at all on duty. So like wine tastings, everyone uses a spit cup. And these are the sort of the expectations for everyone. Like these are the rules you'll follow, and this is what we will do for everyone in return. And it's really this like civil contract that we have with the employees.
Interesting.
And now that we're 5 years in and we have multiple employees who've been here for, you know, over a year. But there's still like quite a few employees who have not. The second you walk in the door here, you figure out the culture. Mm-hmm. Like it's not Andres and I shouting it from the rooftops every single day. The work has been done by putting in the effort to staying at it for the last 5 years and trying our best to stay true to what we are telling everyone we are going to do.
That's incredibly inspiring. And I think it sounds like you are holding up a model that a lot of folks could really look to and learn from. And certainly, you know, I'm inspired by, and I love to hear when team members are being treated equitably, fairly, and, you know, being respected for the hard work that they do. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I think that, for me, this is not easy to do by any means, but for me, I think that, I want to set up the next generation of people who operate and potentially own restaurants to see what's feasible and to understand that like it may take a lot of work and effort, but we can't institute drastic change like this on a statutory level, right? Like no one's going to make a law that says like, this is how you're supposed to do blah, blah, blah. Cause there's always going to be people that don't care that much. in an industry. And so if all these people leave here and they start to manage a restaurant, implement some of our things, or that they do their own thing at one point and it's a part of it, then like that's the most success that Galit can have beyond awards, accolades, you know, how profitable we are. I mean, maybe not superseding like being open for like 20 plus years, that'd pretty mm-hmm. be pretty great. But like in general, that's probably number two, is like when those folks really take what we are creating here together and implementing it elsewhere.
That is a fantastic goal and a wonderful perspective to have, to invest in that future of the industry. Chef Zach, thank you so very much for sharing your story and the story of Galit and the Middle Eastern flavors that are enhanced by those Midwestern ingredients. Thank you for joining the show.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/Eat Your Heartland Out. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.